Ladies and gentlemen, it is showtime. Please welcome the team of the Fulhamish podcast.
It's the Fulhamish podcast, your independent voice of Fulham FC. My name's Sammy James. Welcome to the show. Today, we'll preview Fulham's game against the Seagulls on Saturday. Plus, we'll bask a little bit more in the glory, I think, of Fulham's 2-1 win at Old Trafford against Manchester United. What a weekend it was to be a Fulham fan. Also, we'll go through some of your emails, and we've got a little this'll catch on at the end for you. I'm joined by the regular Thursday club today, Jack Collins. Hello.
Hello, Sammy. How you doing?
Good, thank you. And in an athletic podcast booth somewhere is a Peter Rutzler. Hello.
Yeah, in London, yeah. I've made my own booth, you know. I go to Paris, I just make a booth. Hello, hi everyone. It's good to be back in full-time duty after my other occupations for the last couple of months, which has been fun. I've been on jury service, so that's been a unique experience. So, I'm free now.
Free of the shackles.
Free of the shackles.
Welcome home, my friend.
Yeah, welcome back, Peter. It's lovely to have you. I've never been called up for jury service, have you?
Yeah, it happened to me when I was at university, so I was able to just be like, nah, you're all right.
Okay.
And then I moved away from it then, and I've never been called up again. I think I'm also just still registered at my mum and dad's house for stuff. So, like, if they tried to summon me, I don't think I'd be able to be found.
I mean, people do listen to this podcast. We should maybe just shut up and get on with it. Let's go back and look at Fulham's victory over Manchester. I don't want to give someone ideas if they're the people that select it and they just happen to be Fulham fans. Don't do it. Right. Let's go back and look at what was just an incredible, incredible Saturday to be. How many people, Jack, have you had this week? I've had so many randoms get in touch and be like, good win on Saturday, Sammy. It just feels like everyone's come out of the woodwork.
Yeah, it's been really nice. I got a lot of Liverpool fans coming at me and being like, oh, well done, you beat United. And they'll be like, all right, well done, you beat Chelsea. I think there's been a bit of like a minor love in there. Everyone be like, ah, cheers, done us a favour there. So, yeah, it's
Villa,
been
Villa
nice.
Also, they now love Fulham because we gave them 3 points and then took 3 points off their main rivals for the Champions League.
Yeah, absolutely. We're everyone's best friends now, apart from United, apparently. But yeah, it's been nice.
Villa owe Fulham quite a debt, you know. I mean, this is growing. You've got the playoffs and sacking Gerrard and all of that. You know, it's
count them up
to cash that in at some point.
Yeah, exactly. Count them up. They surely owe us like a John McGinn by now.
They must have a couple of players down the back of the sofa that we could have, an Ezri Konsa.
Yeah. Someone send someone over to us. We deserve it. We've earned it at this point.
Yeah, maybe we like towns get twinned.
Oh no, we're not twinning ourselves. We have to be the stop. That's enough. You've gone too far. You're taking it a step over the breach.
I ruined it. Well, look, let's bask in the glory of Saturday. And Peter, I wanted to start with your brilliant piece that you released on The Athletic on Wednesday. How Fulham beat Manchester United after 21 years of trying. You got the screenshots out and you looked at actually how Marco Silva managed to accomplish this. Not just the fact that it's great to beat Manchester United at Old Trafford, but also to do this without João Palhinha, without Raul Jimenez, without Willian. It was actually a pretty extraordinary bit of tactical genius from the genius that is Marco Silva.
Yeah, quite significant changes actually, really, in the context of what we see from Fulham. You know, we all know what Fulham do on a match day. It's very obvious what they do in terms of their build up in wide areas, and look like Marco Silva and sitting down with his analysts and Antonis Lemonakis and just come on and go, well, let's just exploit that big, massive space that exists in the United midfield. And that's exactly what they did, and they did it to such good effect. You know, I think, you know, speaking after the game, Silva sort of touched on what he did. And I mean, the real basic gist of it was, we'll play Alex Iwobi inside. We'll play Andreas Pereira with a bit more freedom between the lines. Lukic and Reed can be the two players in build-up instead of just one with Palhinha. And we'll be very narrow. And we will exploit that space. We won't need to rely on Robinson's overlapping runs and Castagne on the other side. And it worked so effectively. The number of chances created. Pereira had his best game for a long time, I felt. Of course, where Iwobi was brilliant and got that goal, that winning goal. Probably could have had a couple earlier in the game, actually. And of course, you know, Rodrigo Muniz in attack. It has just been it's a revelation, really, the way he's performing. And again, absolutely fantastic. It's his strength, it's all-round play. You know, the chance he created where he turns Lindelof, doesn't he? It's just so easy. It was reminiscent of that shot he had at Stoke where he scored a bit further out this time, but just managed to generate a load of power on that shot. And his all-round game has been excellent. And I think that's what made the difference, really. I mean, United, I said this to Carl Anker, who was sitting next to me, covers United for us. I said, you're just a burger without any meat in it in midfield. And it was quite remarkable, especially when you're seeing a pitch that big, right? And you just see Casemiro just sort of stuck in it, like in treacle, because there's so much space around him. And then in the second half, it was Eriksen. It was just like, oh my goodness. And Fulham, you know, took full advantage of it.
Yeah, I mean, Jack, it was just mesmerite. You know, the fact is that we were all celebrating because it was a 97th minute winner. This should have been a bit like when Bournemouth went to Old Trafford. This should actually probably, we should be talking here about a 4-1 to Fulham, not actually, you know, it was amazing the way it happened and it was so exciting, but this actually shouldn't have been 2-1. This should have been 3-0.
Yeah, for 85 minutes of the game, there was one team in this and it was Fulham. And this is the thing, and you know, kind of from the opposite perspective, United had, what, won 4 of the last 4 in the league. They'd gone and done the tricky away trips, the Villas, the Wolves, and they come back home against a Fulham side that have won once all season away from home. And you're kind of sitting there going, okay, we haven't seen a particularly brilliant United in recent weeks, but they've had enough to get the job done. And you're kind of watching this game thinking, how? Because if this team is this reliant on Rasmus Højlund being its only source of goals, how have they been able to cope throughout the course of the season? Because Fulham were magic. And the midfield in particular, as kind of Peter points out in his really brilliant piece, I texted Peter to tell him how much I liked it. That's how good I found it. I really enjoyed myself. But, beautiful, you know, we moment. Talked about it in last week's podcast when we were previewing this game, how you replace Polina in and out of possession. And I thought Lukic and Reid did a glorious job.
Finally, Sasa Lukic came into this team after only about a year and a bit of you calling for Sasa Lukic to do something.
Well, it's kind of like when he starts. Every time Sasa starts, he tends to be pretty good. When Sasa comes off the bench, I don't know what happens, but he physically can't get up to speed with the game or whatever it is. But when Sasa comes off the bench, he struggles. And this was a performance of the highest order from both of them. In fact, I mean, it was a performance of the highest order from most players on the team. You'd struggle to find a Fulham player that had a bad game. But in particular, I thought the combinations between Reid and Lukic in the middle, and I was watching a couple of United things to kind of see what the perspective on it was from the other end. And I was watching Flex on DR Sports, and he basically was like, we made Harrison Reid look like Pirlo. And I was like, that's a strange comparison. I've heard Harrison Reid compared to lots of famous old school footballers, but I don't think Andrea Pirlo has ever been one of them. But it was just the way he was popping into the pockets and just making the triangles tick in the middle. And there were so many bodies, as you know, as that kind of narrowness of Fulham's structure pointed out, that we were just able to knock off those triangles and play through the United press as if it was non-existent. Now, they didn't help themselves. Casemiro, I hate to use the word washed, but like, it really does feel like his legs have gone. He physically can't move around the pitch. And you could see almost immediately Iwobi and Pereira go, oh, we're going to be able to get to him. And you see the chances that Iwobi takes. There's one, obviously, where he knocks it wide in the first half. There's another one where he gets a shot away and it's saved. There's a Muniz chance where he does really well as well. And all of it, you're like, how is there this much galloping open space in the middle of the park? I thought Marco Silva took advantage of it perfectly. And that's the key advantage of a manager who's able to adapt and change his system to suit the situation. And one that as soon as one key player was knocked out, was unable to react to the situation. And look, Marco Silva deserves all the praise in the world.
I like how Iwobi, before, I think there was an interview with the club, right? And he's asked about the United game. And he goes, oh, there's so much space at Old Trafford. It was almost like, you know, the pitch is massive. And I think ordinarily think, oh, it's a big pitch. But then actually when you watch the game, it was almost a hint about what was on the cards, really, the amount of space they were expecting. And we saw it play out, and you know, he took full advantage, didn't he?
Yeah. I swear there's not actually that much between Premier League pitches. A lot of it's like perception, isn't there? When you actually look at the dimensions, I know some, like a lot of people
say... A couple of metres is a lot of space when you're actually, you're actually on it, I suppose.
Yeah. As I say, I'm not a professional footballer, so I wouldn't know. Peter, one point that you picked up on in your piece was that actually, if you look at Calvin Bassey and Alex Iwobi's consecutive games when they started, it's looking pretty good. A 2-1 win over Arsenal and a 2-1 win over Manchester United. They have now become so vital, both of them. Particularly for me, Bassey, when he plays, we just look like a different animal.
Yeah, he's adapted really, really well. I think the key thing with those two, I felt, was the way they've just responded after AFCON, because, you know, it's less than 2 weeks since, or around 2 weeks since the final. I mean, that's such a massive deal, you know, to lose a continental final, to lose, you know, when you're so close to the trophy and you're carrying the weight of a nation on your shoulders. And of course, in particular with Alex Iwobi, with the horrible abuse he then suffered afterwards, to be reintegrated this quickly and to just get back up to speed so swiftly is another example again of good management, right? It's putting them into the right environment. You know, his teammates obviously as well playing a big part for both of them, just getting around them and getting them up to speed. And it looks like they've just picked up exactly where they've left off, which was that win over Arsenal. I think in Iwobi's case, I think he's been really consistent, I think, ever since he signed, playing regardless of his positions as well. You know, it's not like he's just played in one set role. He's actually played across the front line, hasn't he? He's played on the left, as he did at Old Trafford, in the middle, on the right. You know, I think he probably suffered a lot because of that when he was at Arsenal, or at least not finding his right position. Then when he found his right position at Everton, he kicked on and did really well. But now it seems like Fulham are getting a lot out of him wherever they play him. And that comes down to organisation and instruction and him feeling confident in the system. And Bassey, you know, it was difficult for him, wasn't it? Because of the games he was thrown into at the start on the right side of defence, you know, adapting to the Premier League for the first time. And I mean, that's tough. That's a real baptism of fire. But when he's on the left-hand side, you know, we can see the quality he's got and what he adds in terms of his dynamism and how solid both he and Tosin were as a pairing at the back. So, I mean, they've been fantastic additions, haven't they? They were the big money signings last summer and both of them have been excellent.
Just on the centre-back partnership, I thought it was telling that Marcus Rashford looked disinterested by 15 minutes in because they didn't give him a sniff. Now, part of this was United not being able to get the ball to him, but any time it did get near him, one of the two of them would be like, nope, see you later, and off Fulham would go again. And that's disheartening for a player, especially when they've been moved into an unfamiliar position, somewhere where they haven't been great, and there is that kind of sort of Damocles hanging over them from the fan base anyway, where there's a big debate over, you know, and we're not going to go into it, we're not a Man United podcast, but the way you can quieten a crowd and then also make a player be like, well, just what's the point? I've not got any support, I've not got any service. And anytime the ball, I would get a lucky bounce or something happens, I'm being completely shut off by these two centre-backs. I thought it was that kind of performance where it's so dominant that it felt like there was never, ever going to be any chance of Rashford bringing United into the game. There are other places where you could go, okay, you can maybe get joy here. That was never one of them.
Yeah. And Peter, the final bit in your, the kind of final section of your article, go read it, The Athletic, go read the full thing. Adama Traore, the wild card, you called him. And I am loving this wild card. I want us to play it every game. It's just so much fun. He makes me enjoy football. He makes me get off the edge of my seat. And the fact that actually this time, finally, something productive came of the Adama Traore wild card was just hugely exciting to see. I also, I don't know if any of you noticed this, Fulham posted and all the angles of Iwobi's goal. And so it's basically just Iwobi's goal on repeat about 10 times. I've watched it 10 times. And there's a United fan that gets picked up on the camera saying, get him, Maguire. Get him, Harry. Something like that. Harry gets nowhere near him.
have you seen the, there's a clip as well of Garnacho looking over to the bench when Traore's coming on, and yes, he just goes, effing hell.
Yeah, very enjoyable.
Like, what other player in the Premier League can do that? I absolutely love watching him. When you see him getting ready, you think, yes. Because it's just excitement, right? You just know exactly what he's going to bring. He's definitely going to sprint at some point, and it's going to be amazing. Like, it's just so pure, right? So raw. Like, man is faster than all other men. It's great to watch in the flesh. And yeah, as you said, Sammy, you know, he actually delivered here and got that final third bit. It was Villa. He had that chance to level the game, didn't he?
Yeah.
And then, of course, that sprint at the Emirates where he outran Saliba to go one-on-one to win the game and didn't quite there. But yeah, kept his composure. And when he does that, I mean, it's just such a great option to have. Like, it's especially, you know, against, it was Lindelof, wasn't it? Left back for United. You think, okay, he's in a bit of bother here, especially. It was just perfect for that scenario, wasn't it? Because United had just turned into chaos. I mean, their goal was just Harry Maguire just literally bundling around in the penalty area, and then it just keeps sticking, and then he knocks one in. The game was wide open, so much space, and it just needed one sprint. What a bloody sprint.
I just have this vision of someone dubbing over the old quote. It was like Lindelof turning to Maguire as Adama's being ready to be like, there's a storm coming, Harry. We all best be ready when she does. Like, that's exactly the scene. I mean, look, third time lucky for Adama, but... yeah, exactly. This is the unleashable weapon. If he's fit and firing, being able to do this, even if it's a 10, 15 minutes a game, is just one of those things that... And look, Ali Garnacho was almost certainly every United fan, but oh, for God's sake. Like really? He has to deal with this in this kind of weird, mad, chaotic game where space is everywhere, where they've run through us at will. They're going to throw in the fastest man in the Premier League. Okay, cool. No worries. No bother. We'll just leave it at that, I suppose. Let's just call it here.
I'm slightly interested, Peter, and I don't know if you have any insight on this, but Tom Kearney said it in like a sponsored video, but also I listened to, and actually I'd really encourage any Fulham fan to listen. So Tom Kearney's been appearing on the Players channel, and it's the Footballers Football podcast. So it used to be Mikel Antonio and Callum Wilson, but Callum Wilson's not doing it anymore. And Tom Kearney's now done, I think, three or four in a row. And it's a guy that hosts it called Ricky Hayward-Williams, who actually is someone I used to work with really closely at another job that I did. And I used to enjoy this podcast, but particularly since Kearney's on there, I've been listening to every one. Go check it out, because I actually think Tom's brilliant on it. But one thing...
very good on Sky as well. He was a pundit last night.
Oh, he's so tailor-made for that role.
I really enjoy it. I think he's doing a great job. Yeah, that's TC.
Yeah, well done, TC. But one thing he said, the question came up from a listener, and they said, oh, who's the... kind of like person that's been fined most at your club, whatever. And so I think Mikel Antonio very diplomatically swerved, effectively trying to say Kurt Zouma for everything that happened there. But Tom Kearney went out on a limb again and said, oh yeah, Adama has been fined a lot of late fines for Adama. And I'm just trying to work out, Peter, if this is a kind of like endearing, like, oh, Adama, he's always late. Or if this is like, who is this bloke? He just keeps turning up late and he's really annoying. And I can't work out. Like,
the physio doesn't know when to come in anymore because Adama keeps turning up late.
Do you think it's a bit more the former at the moment, Peter, of like, oh, it's Adama, he's okay, he's fine, he just comes in late?
Yeah, it's generally quite a good group at Fulham, by all accounts. So I guess it's more on the endearing side. But he said it a couple of times, doesn't he? Because I saw it previously when he mentioned it. It was like a 1-2-3. I think it was Ty Francois and Willian at the same time all said the same name. So yeah, it's definitely a theme. It's definitely been picked up on, hasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, if he keeps doing things like... I guess with all players, if you keep delivering on the pitch and you keep... yeah, putting in assists, listen, for
he
last
must be
minute
like,
winners.
I only play 10 minutes at the end of games. I don't need as much training as the rest of you. Like, the rest of you are playing 90s regularly. Because like, I only come on at the end.
I think the tricky thing for him, obviously he's had these hamstring issues, which have kept him out. And, you know, I've had an amount of people who would tweet being like, oh, where's Adama? Is Adama out? Is he back? Does he exist? That kind of thing. He's obviously, he came back briefly for the Villa game away, if I remember rightly. And then... basically had a setback with the same injury. So it's not been that easy to really settle in and find any kind of rhythm at Fulham so far. And you just hope that when you get a moment like you do at Old Trafford, that can sort of build a bond with the club you've signed for, you know, because he's just not really been visible. So in the same way that probably applies to Sasa Lukic as well.
All right, well, we'll take a break there. Afterwards, we'll look ahead to Fulham's next game, which is against Brighton on Saturday.
This is an advertisement for BetterHelp, a portal for finding online therapy. How's your social battery right now? If you feel a bit drained or lacking enthusiasm to meet all the social commitments in your life, then that can be a totally normal thing, especially with things picking up as we head out of winter. I know that pretty frequently a weekend just doing a few chores and watching the football was about the limit of my energy resources, but therapy can be a place to help you gain the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your batteries. Contrary to popular belief, therapy isn't just for those who have experienced major trauma. The overall goal is to empower you to be the best version of yourself. And if therapy is something you've considered, then why not give BetterHelp a try? BetterHelp is entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. They'll match you with a UK mental health professional with a wide variety of expertise. There's no referral needed, and you can switch therapists at any time for no additional charge, giving you complete control over the whole experience. Fulhamish listeners get 10% off their first month at betterhelp.com/fulhamish. That's betterhelp.com/fulhamish.
Part two of the Fulhamish podcast. Sammy here with Jack Collins and Peter Rutzler. Thank you very much to Green King Sport for backing the Thursday Club this season. If you want to go watch any televised sport, head to your local Green King Sports pub. That could be football, it could be the Rugby Six Nations. Not that I've got very much interest in that anymore as an England fan, but Jack certainly does as a Grand Slam chasing Ireland fan. Also, the F1 is back this weekend. The Bahrain Grand Prix is on Saturday. Annoyingly, pretty much the same time as the Fulham game. I'm pretty fuming about that. Keep it on a Sunday. And also this weekend, the Manchester Derby on Sunday at 3:30. Fulham not on the telly, but if you want to, you know, get a bit of a loose end on Sunday and you want to go watch the Manchester Derby, head to your local Green King Sport pub. It'll be on there on one of their big HD TVs. Plus, you can get 10% off your drinks with the Green King Sports app during any televised sporting event. Right, let's look ahead then to Brighton on Saturday. And Jack, Brighton is a team. If you think that Man United has been a team that's definitely had our number up until Saturday in recent years, Brighton just seems to be one of those that they're a very, very good team. We just do seem to do okay against them. I'm hoping we can keep that going on Saturday.
Yeah, well, the polar, we hit the magnets, haven't we? The magnets have switched. We're now gonna get thumped by Brighton, considering we've beaten Manchester United. Look, it's I think this is a winnable game. And although Brighton are excellent, and there's no doubting that, and they have impressed again this season, building on and losing some key players, you know, lost entire midfield last summer in Alexis and Moises Caicedo. They've been able to kick on again. They've been very good in Europe, a little bit less so in the Premier League. But they're still up there chasing those European spots, and they're still in that conversation. So I think De Zerbi's doing a very, very good job there. What's interesting, though, is that obviously they play tonight, as we're recording this, against Wolves in the FA Cup. We've just seen Karim Mitoma out for the season, sadly, with an injury that's going to keep him out. Evan Ferguson is missing for this game. It's going to be a touch and go whether he returns to the side. There's a couple more injuries as well. We're at a space now where this Brighton side are not running on fumes. But I think if you rack that injury list up against any of the, you know, teams that are talked about with huge injury crises, there wouldn't be much in it. And so we're talking about a squad that is a little bit light, have to play 3 days before us. We get a full week's rest after a massive result at home. Fulham should be absolutely looking at this as winnable. And, you know, that's before the fact that Brighton sides have tended to struggle at the Cottage in recent years. That's not to say that this will definitely be a game that Fulham win. I'm not coming into it being like, oh, 3 points are the necessity. But we're now at a kind of strange point where, you know, Liverpool winning the Carabao Cup at the weekend potentially means that European places could go all the way down to eighth. We're 6 points behind Wolves and 7 behind West Ham after the action on Monday night. There is an outside chance, and it remains a deeply outside chance. I'm not suggesting that this is going to be, oh, if we don't get there, then it's a problem. But there remains now an outside chance that Fulham, with a late push, with all these players coming back from injuries, from suspensions, from international duty, might be able, and with the pressure off as well, because the gap is now so, you know, clean, I think, to the relegation zone, especially with the fact that we think Forest and Everton will have further points penalties to come. It's almost like, okay, we'll go and have a go at it and see what happens. And I think that's quite an exciting place to be for a Fulham side that now has what it feels like a wealth of attacking riches in the right kind of areas, starting to come good at the right time.
Yeah, and there's basically only one relegation spot left, considering that there's 19 points for Burnley and Sheffield United to make up. I mean, Peter, Brighton, as Jack mentioned, got some absences. Billy Gilmore to add to that as well, because obviously he picked up a red card against Everton. And Brighton's form's been a bit strange, Peter, if you look at their recent results, because they've got some like outstanding results in there. Like they went to Bramall Lane and won 5-0. They beat Palace 4-1, which is obviously a huge game for them. But actually, they've conceded a lot of goals this year, an awful lot of goals. I mean, much was made of the fact that pretty much every game Brighton both teams to score was the most solid bet in the entire Premier League. They just don't seem to have that kind of edge that they had last year. When Fulham went to Brighton and won, it was a massive, massive shock. But I think if Fulham won this weekend, it would be nowhere near as big a shock.
Yeah, they're much, I was going to say the word looser, but they're not as controlling, I think, as they were last year. And I think injuries in Europe plays the part in that. You know, I think the disruption and rotation, you can't prepare with the same amount of time or detail as you would ordinarily. You need to rely on more of your squad. And I think we're seeing sort of the impact of that. The Gilmore thing's interesting because, you know, as Jack said, you know, they lost their two starting midfielders this year. Gilmore has sort of become that, or him and Pascal Gross next to each other have formed quite a good partnership. So that's now been disrupted. So yeah, you're right, Sammy. I don't think it would be a shock for Fulham to win, regardless of, you know, Fulham's recent results against them. It was 6 points last year, wasn't it? So they're not quite the same team at the moment. But the thing is, we all know what they're capable of when they do show up, and their results really do reflect it, don't they? You know, 5 against Sheffield United, 4-1 against Palace. That's not an easy game to do that. But it's only 2 wins this year. I think there's been this sort of, particularly since, you know, they had a good start, but it's just they found the winter period quite testing. Mm-hmm. You know, they'll have an eye on the trip to Rome next week.
Yeah, massive.
Which is a huge game for them, as you'd expect. It's knockout European football. They've not hit the same heights, really. But yeah, they've still got quality in their team. We've seen that week in, week out. So I guess the real question is how Fulham sort of set up for it, and how they sort of adapt post United to a different game, a home game. Do Fulham revert back to what worked before? Do they keep the same sort of setup? Particularly if, say, Willian does become available, because I think that would be quite an interesting question if you want to do things out wide, or whether you want to sort of maintain that sort of narrow focus as well.
I think it's probably somewhere in the middle, right? I think that when we're looking at what Fulham will set up like, can you imagine him making huge amounts of changes from a team that played so well, not just one at Old Trafford, but played so well at Old Trafford? I think you'd struggle to make loads of changes from that side. So I think that the personnel might be pretty similar in terms of what we see here. What I think he might do is just ask for a little bit more width from those fullbacks. And, you know, obviously we just talked about Brighton's midfield and maybe being able to dominate those spaces as well. But there's equally a chance that Brighton go, okay, if we're going to be a little bit more open in midfield, we go three at the back, someone else comes back in to go alongside Duncan Van Hecker. And if that happens, then obviously you need to try and find that width from wingbacks or fullbacks in our case, trying to get round their wingbacks and kind of ask a little bit more there. So I think Fulham will be a little bit reactive. I can imagine the 11 being exactly the same as what it was against Manchester United, but just with an eye on being like, okay, we're not going to know how Brighton set up until an hour beforehand. At that point, we kind of play the strategy a little bit differently depending on what we think that their shape is going to look like in real time. And look, we just talked about adaptability and being able to react to situations. I trust Marco Silva to get that right. Mm-hmm. So we're in a nice space in that space, in that they will be chopping and changing not only with a busy fixture schedule, but also with the players that are being forced in and out of the side, as opposed to us who can go, okay, right, we know what the 11 is. All we need to decide in that hour beforehand is which of our strategies we're going to utilise to try and open up this Brighton side. And that's a nice place to be for Marco Silva and for Fulham.
I mean, I guess I just wondered, Peter, does TC come back in? It's a home game. He didn't start at Old Trafford. But then you alluded to in your piece that the combination of Reid and Lukic was able to kind of recreate Polina in the aggregate, wasn't
yeah,
it?
There he is. There's a reference.
That it was just, I wonder if like actually you can't put Kearney in because Reid and Lukic effectively are doing what you miss when you don't have João Polina at the base of midfield.
Yeah, it's an interesting point. I think with Reid and Lukic, the way it worked at Old Trafford, you had Reid being a bit more conservative than normal. I think both Lukic and Lukic was as well. But the way they pressed was still quite aggressive. They could do that. You know, they screened really well. You had Pereira and Muniz as the two up top, just stopping any passes, easy passes into the middle. United couldn't build up in wide areas because they didn't have Luke Shaw and they're just not good enough in those areas. And you just had Fernandez and I think it was later McTominay who came on, just not involved in the game, and Maynard just not physical enough yet. So they were able to stay on top of that. I think with the difference, I think with the home game as well, because how Polina, you know, say Polina takes the ball off the back line, he does cover a lot of spaces. That was the thing that Marco Silva said afterwards. Now, Reid and Lukic together can do that. Lukic isn't really the type of player who can cover that ground to make a massive slide tackle, if that makes sense. He can cover the ground, but that's not his
with the
that's
ball, not
really
not
his
without
game.
It.
Yes. Yeah, that's a good way of putting it, actually. Reid can do that, but he doesn't have the same sort of physical presence as Polina does, or indeed, actually, with Lukic. And I just wonder, because when Lukic drops in as the six, he hasn't been, I don't think, as strong in terms of protecting the ball, I think, in my opinion. I think United was the first time where I felt, okay, actually, it's almost like the way he started that game, it was like, I've got a point to prove here in this specific area of my game. It was almost like the end of Villa where he gets his yellow card. It's like, right, I need to show I can do this. Obviously mistimed it and got booked in that game. But with United, I think after minute and a half, I think he goes flying into, is it Casemiro, I think?
Yeah, I think it was.
And regains possession. It was a perfect turnover, and he did that so many times during the game. So I do wonder whether that might be a cause to change things up a little bit. What you don't want, and I think what Fulham will want to avoid, is Lukic being isolated in the six. What worked quite well is that he had his mid, Fulham were more compact, right? So you had Reid being quite compact next to him, and helped, I think. And Brighton aren't going to be as tactically open as United will be. So, but does that bring Tom Kearney? And that's the interesting. That's really interesting, I think. Pereira had a really free role. So rather than, whereas Kearney would be on the left, say, would go over to the left and combine with Robinson and say it's Willian or Iwobi. It wasn't really like that at Old Trafford at all. It was, you know, Pereira was almost anywhere he wanted to be. Iwobi was more central, and there was just nothing on the left, and Robinson could cover it if he needed to, but didn't have to do that very much. So if you bring Kearney and you bring back that structure, don't you? You bring back a wider midfield structure. So, and as Jack said, there's positives and negatives to that, and I think, you know, Fulham's most effective way of playing is getting Robinson through, isn't it?
I think that is the kind of thing that really sets up your fear there. I think bringing Kearney back in isolates Lukic in the six.
Yeah.
So when you come to that kind of point and you're looking at how do you not make that happen, you have to play him alongside another player in the pivot. Whereas, and look, Marco said it afterwards, he's like, normally you play one defensive midfielder and two in front of him, which I thought was an interesting way of him discussing how he's utilised Tom Kearney this year. Because I think most of us would picture Silva side, and I think most people generally, you know, as a 4-2-3-1, but clearly that's not quite how he's seeing it, because you know, this felt very much like two at the base, and that's what he said. So when you're kind of looking at, if you bring Tom Kearney back in instead of a Reid or a Lukic, you are effectively going back to a one at the base position in midfield, but is that going to work quite the same way in this game as it did in the last? I don't know, but I don't think that if that happens, I think it's Harrison Reid that keeps his spot, not Lukic, because as you say, you don't want him as the solo pivot in that exact space.
Yeah, and you think about the way Kearney's played for Fulham this year. He's actually played a much deeper role on the left. And that's because the left eight, which is where he'll play in that triangle, will drop into almost the fullback position. You'll see Pereira do it on the right. You'll see Iwobi do it on the right. And you know, I think Pereira does it less when he's on the left, which might make him more influential in the final third, actually. But that, as you say, means Kearney's the closest one to Lukic, or it'll be Pereira on that side will be closest to Lukic. And that's not as solid, I think. And that's probably why Reed gets the shoe in. And I think, you know, the other question is, you know, does Pereira drop out? Well, I think the one thing Pereira does a lot, and I know his offensive output hasn't been, I don't think he's been as effective as last year so far, but his off-ball work is clearly valued.
Yeah, it's magnificent.
He triggers the press. He is the first line, you know, alongside Muniz. It's him who's doing that. Like, he covers so much ground. And I think that tactical element will probably give him the edge in that position. So I guess, long story short, I can imagine there isn't a reshuffle in midfield.
Yeah. And you just thought with that Willian coming back, but, you know, Iwobi can do such a good job on that left-hand side. Like, why rush him back?
Yeah, yeah. Also, you know, if you need something, then you can bring Willian off the bench. And Peter's spot on. You can criticise loads of stuff about Andreas Pereira's game if you are so inclined. His productivity levels, you know, hitting the bar from every single free kick he's ever taken. But you can't criticise ever his work rate. There has never been a game where I've watched Pereira and gone, oh, he's not putting it in today. He's not putting the shift in. There are times where the quality hasn't been there, but you never, ever, ever criticise him from a perspective of what he's putting in and leaving on the pitch.
No, if you watch, if you ever, you know, home game or whatever, I remember watching particularly, there was a moment in like the second half where I watched just when Villa had the ball and like often it went to Pau Torres on the left-hand side. And Andreas Pereira just does not stop kind of going between defenders, really working hard off the ball. You can see why Marco Silva wants him in the lineup. It must just be frustrating for Marco. He was like, if you just like had a slightly better decision-making, or I actually do think often it is decision-making with him when he's on the ball, he'd be such a force.
Yeah, I'd also add that he's been playing a lot more on the right this season compared to last year. Last year, it was just the same left, wasn't it? Pereira, Willian, Robinson as a three. Kearney's obviously come in and Pereira's moved to the right. I wouldn't say Pereira's not comfortable there, but I don't think he's been as effective in that position.
You don't get the jet heels quite as much. No. He doesn't sort of send a defender and off he goes. I think it's interesting though. Obviously, you look at the two number 10s, if you will, in inverted commas, less so, I suppose, but at the weekend, and you know, one of these players was released by Manchester United and one of them, they put the faith in to build an entire squad around, and Pereira was far and away the better player. One, he didn't spend most of his time rolling around on the deck. But two, you know, the link-up play, the work rate, all of it. And perhaps at the very, very top level, work rate alone isn't enough. And maybe that's why it came down to it that Pereira didn't succeed at Manchester United. But I think we often talk about players, you're like, if you're not having a good game, if you're struggling to get yourself right, if your passes aren't coming off, your little flicks aren't working, especially in that kind of role, if you still put in your shift till the end and you make sure that, you know, you're the last thing that anyone could ever criticize is your running, your pressing, your work rate, people will love you. And that's why I almost always advocate that Pereira should be within a Fulham unit, unless it's a Iwobi that comes into the 10, in which case you get that as well. Sometimes with a little bit more.
Yeah, that's the thing, because Iwobi can do that role, can't he? So yeah, exactly. That'll be interesting to see if he does at some point.
And just finally on who starts, there's no debate now, is there? It's old Rodrigo up front.
No debate.
No debate at all. I mean, Peter, we've got 12 games left of the season. Apparently, according to your report, although you didn't have it confirmed, but I think you were fairly sure, Armando Broia needs to start 10 plus in order to save the fee. I mean, it's probably just going to happen at this point, isn't it? We're going to have to pay the money.
Money well spent, wouldn't it?
Best four million Fulham have spent in the market in years.
I mean, it's basically transformed Muniz's value by four. So that's probably
and the rest.
And the rest.
I would like to see Broia get on. I will add this. And look, as I said a couple of weeks ago, it's Muniz's spot until something changes in that he either has a poor game or Broia comes on and is like absolutely unbelievable. Those are two things that could change, it could shift this a little bit. But I mean, there's no sign of either of them at the moment. So for now, big R9 up top.
He has been excellent. I know I said at the start of the podcast, but just his all-round game, everything, it's confidence, isn't it? It's just like with Jimenez, score a goal and suddenly it's, you know, I feel like I belong in this team and can perform and people believe in you. Like there was one of the attacks, I think, where Castagna picks up the ball in the right-back position, and I don't really envisage Fulham doing this very much. I can't really remember Fulham doing this, particularly this season, but they would always do it with Mitrovic. Just going along, just hitting him, just going straight direct, and that one pass... Muniz beats Varane in the air. Varane had a terrible afternoon. Knocks it down and Wobi runs onto it and maybe should have scored actually. But it's that kind of thing, that confidence, those sort of moments in games where you see, actually, do you know what, everyone... It's the same with Jimenez earlier in the season as well. Actually, do you know what, I back him to do this. I can hit it. I know if I put it in that direction, he's going to make something of it, and he's doing that really well. And I'm pleased for him because, you know, he must have had such a terrible time at Middlesbrough last season. You know, he spent, what, three months or more, not even in the squad. So you're training, not playing in the northeast of England. You know, you're learning English. You know, you're away from home once removed because your home is Fulham, and you know, loads of, you've got a nice social group there at Fulham. I mean, we can see the Lusophone speakers, as you'd say, Jack, within the group. And to come back to get this chance, and I think, you know, when you're looking at, you know, the team, everyone's crying out for a striker, and you see Breuer arrive and then you get this one chance. It was just like the Man United game at home. That felt like that one chance, and he went off in tears, didn't he? Because he got that knee injury.
Yeah.
And then, you know, goes to a Turf Moor and we saw that emotional reaction to his goal. But that's because it was that, you know, it was real sliding doors, wasn't it? But he took it and with, you know, Fulham are reaping the benefits from it.
Yeah, hasn't looked back since.
Yeah. Got old Rodrigo Muniz keeping... I mean, he's keeping the dream alive, isn't he? It's honestly amazing to see. And I'm fascinated by these rumours linking him and Pereira, in fairness, with the Brazil squad for the March internationals.
Yeah, I think that might be a stretch too far. But look, you never know. Weirder things have happened. Harrison Reed's linked to
me. I can't wait for the March international break. You're going to see Harrison Reed play for England and Rodrigo Muniz and Andrés
Pereira. Money Muniz up top for Brazil and the Seleção. Unbelievable.
Honestly, I'll pay all the... I'll fly over to South America to cover it for Fulhamish. I'll loosely base it as an expense just for all of us to...
there'll be a couple of people fighting you for that flight.
Yeah. Might also use all of the Green King money and quite a lot more. Right, we'll take a break there. Afterwards, we'll answer some of your emails. Part three of the Fulhamish podcast. This will catch on in a moment. It's been great to have that back in our lives. Peter, honestly, he's been bugging me every week. He's texting me saying, Sammy, I'm really missing This Will Catch On. I've been doing jury service.
Some light in his life.
Yeah, he's really missed it. And, you know, I'm glad that he gets to have his fix today. he says nothing.
I'll leave confirmation of whether that's true or not to the public.
Some emails before that. Tim Lundy says, Hi Fulhamish, after another ludicrous team of the week from Garth Crooks on BBC Sport.
Stop looking at
still
them,
going.
Man.
Is that still going?
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
Great.
Played Mooney's on the wing the other day.
Which routinely overlooks Fulham players, and this week includes Bassey, but uses that as an opportunity to talk only about Man United. Do you think that it is a benefit that Fulham are consistently treated as making up the numbers? As frustrating as it can be, does it help us hang on to some of our players and manager, and also take the pressure off the team when media expectations are simply absent? And if so, should we be happy with forever peaking in mid-table? Thanks, Tim.
I think there's a deeper point here that goes beyond Garth Crooks. Like, if you're kind of looking at how successful and relatively well-run clubs operate, so let's exclude a couple of the big guns from that, but they're not going to be looking at Garth Crooks' team of the week and be like, oh, I should sign that guy. They are going to be looking at one, performances, two, data, three, scout reports. It's going to be far deeper and more cohesive than that.
I think, though, what he says later is like the media expectations is a bit more...
About Marco, I actually think maybe this is the most important point. Like, as Marco Silva continues to go under the radar, that one's a little bit different because the clubs that are smart enough that should be appointing Marco Silva... probably wouldn't be in terms of where they sit in the food chain and what their fan bases expect from a new manager. Our big problem, I think, would come in the kind of mid space. Like if a Tottenham were re-looking for a manager next summer, I'd be a bit concerned. But I don't think Angie's going anywhere. So that one's fine. They're the, you know, I'm not hugely worried about like a Liverpool or, you know, a Manchester United poaching a Marco Silva, because I think that that in itself would cause uproar within their fan base. And that's where the media, maybe turn off, I suppose, is actually quite useful, because I think at the weekend, you know, I talked about this earlier, Marco Silva showed as a manager he was able to adapt to a situation where he was lacking a couple of his best players and put together a cohesive game plan. Erik ten Hag just didn't. Now, one of those managers is lauded as, and look, I like ten Hag, this isn't a personal attack on him, but I think he struggles in certain situations, and this is one of them. He's not particularly adaptable or flexible, and when, therefore, everything falls apart, everything can fall apart. I don't think you ever would get that with a Marco Silva, because he's able to react to situations and think about plans that allow him to alter his situations in different ways.
I think Jack's right. I think for managers, that's where the media can play a part, because it can shape the thinking of what is a good appointment, how is it going to be received, and that kind of thing. So maybe that hinders Marco Silva, helps Fulham. And, you know, just bringing him up, because I was just updating my list of sort of firsts that have happened under Silva. So obviously it's the first win over United since 2003, and that goes for, maybe it's for another podcast, we go for him, but there's been so many, you know, most Premier League wins, most Premier League goals last season, most away wins, first victory over Arsenal since 2012, first title for 20 years, most goals in the league season since 1932. This is just the Fulham side of things, so rather than sort of in the league. It's just those kind of things won't get the same sort of coverage, I think, and that may shape opinion maybe. And the other thing that came to mind when you brought that up was refereeing. And I think Fulham fans and we'll look at the scrutiny that some decisions get that I think the bigger clubs will, because there's just more eyes on it and there's more interest in it. Even the point about new referees being appointed at Fulham, which has happened a few times a season.
Yeah.
And you just think, well, that's fine. That's, you know, it's a compliment that in a way that they feel like it's a good place to go, but it's also, is that not a competitive issue? Like that you're not having the experienced ones doing certain games. I don't want to go too much into that, but I think that's where it maybe can twist it. But it's an interesting question, because there's lots of layers to it.
Yeah. Actually, my next question relates to refereeing. So I'll come on to that now from Daniel Slade. He did send this before the United game, but it's still relevant to read now. Hi, Fulhamish crew, long-time listener, first-time emailer. Ka-ching.
Love it.
After Villa on Saturday, I felt compelled to email and ask your opinion on how well you feel referees are doing clamping down on time-wasting. I realise all clubs do it, including our own, but having watched Aston Villa do it for the entire second half and the referee failed to penalise them, I was amazed that only 5 minutes were added on, and then furious when the ball was in play for only 57 seconds of those 5 minutes, with the referee inexplicably blowing up pretty much bang on 95 minutes. Surely the game as a whole deserves better than this. Dan from Tonbridge. I know you guys talked about it on that podcast that you did. I mean, we didn't discuss it though last week, the extra time and how fuming people were. I was fuming, everyone was fuming with that extra time.
Yeah,
I generally feel like it's been better, the amount of time added on this. I think it's genuinely improved the game that, like, we now get 8-9 minutes added on. But that game was weird that they failed to clamp down on it, but Fulham were just as guilty of our own demise in that match.
Yeah, I mean, it started better, I think. We've seen a drop-off from it since. And look, it relates back to the old point. You're always going to get different results. United score an 88th-minute equaliser, 9 minutes added on. They're ahead the week before, 4 minutes added on. And now I'm not saying that those two games are exactly the same, but they're definitely more. I've got tin foil above me. But there definitely wasn't a 5 minute disparity in the two games in terms of what happened. So
it came back to bite them.
So like in this case, it's not, you know, it's another one where, and you talk about big decisions, right? If Fulham and if Harry Maguire wasn't sent off, and look, wherever you sit on that challenge, that's fine, but I think it's a red card. Now, Fulham win the game, so it's not that big a deal. If there was a Fulham player that didn't get sent off for the same challenge and United lost the game 2-1, we wouldn't have heard anything else for the last 3 weeks. Now, United are a bigger club than Fulham. None of us kidding ourselves here. We're not suggesting that, you know, the two are given equal media representation. And that was also fine because you have to play to an audience. You have to understand, you know, who wants what, clicks, etc., listens, fine. But there is a sense to be like, well, hang on, is it not about getting it right? And I saw a tweet the other day, which I think it was about the Champions League rather than the, you know, rather than the Premier League, but the point, same point stands. And it was basically like the dark heart, the truth of all these debates about VAR and decisions, et cetera, is that no one actually wants, as fans, the decisions to be right. They just want the decisions to be the ones that their team wants. Like, ultimately, that's what you want. You want Fulham to get the right decisions because that's how we feel about things because we're football fans and we want our team to do as best as possible. And then when it doesn't go our way, we cover up, but all we want is fairness. We're like, no, we don't. We wouldn't be talking a moment about it if those things happen. And that's why with the Villa time-wasting bit a little bit, like Fulham weren't particularly time-wasty at United, but we definitely weren't as quick to balls as we could have been, etc. It comes back to bite Man United. If they score late, that comes back to bite us, right? It's a different thing, but I'm not going to be mad about Villa. I thought the 5 minutes and the way that it was handled was bad, but equally, you can lead to your own demise in that regard. And if Adama had scored the equaliser, and Villa would have been fuming about the fact that those 5 minutes might have been cut short. And that's where it all comes back to. It's just about wanting what's best for us. And I appreciate it because I am a Fulham fan. But it's not to say that every case is the same.
I think the Villa officiating, I can't remember his name now, the young lad.
Lewis.
But that comes, Lewis Smith, wasn't it? Lewis Smith. Yeah. I think that comes back to my point of the previous question. That just felt like an experience to me, those last 5-10 minutes of the game. Different intensity of game, first time you're experiencing it, and I think it just happened. I think the rest of the game he actually did kind of well compared to some of the other new referees we've had, but it's and that's where it comes back to. It's like, well, you've got to give referees you've got to blood them to improve the pool, but you know, if you keep giving them to the same team, I think it's...
They can't all be blooded at Craven Cottage.
Yeah, that's what I mean. You know, like,
give some of them to Brighton. Like, there are other grounds that you can go and they're not going to get all that much stick. It's probably fine.
Yeah. I just also don't really see why... Yeah, it did just feel a little bit easy for the Premier League just to be constantly like, a Fulham. And there is an element of they do, like, quite tactically choose where referees go, not just based on where they're from and stuff. But I thought it was interesting that Chris Kavanagh is the VAR for this weekend's game against Brighton. Obviously, Chris Kavanagh, the referee at Old Trafford. Chris Kavanagh hasn't reffed a Fulham game since the Mitro incident.
Yeah.
Which, to me, can't be a coincidence.
No. Absolutely not.
It won't be.
But also, you're trying to get...
And it's also, that's the sensible thing to do, isn't it?
Yeah, correct. Yeah, yeah. That's absolutely fine. Like, yeah, and but also, there has to come a point, you can't keep Chris Kavanagh away from Fulham games forever. Like, yeah, much no. as we might like that. Like, we at some point, you just got to be like, well, on we go. Yeah. So it is what it is.
One more email from Michael Heatley, who is, again...
Hey, Michael.
Yeah, his subject is, yes, it's Drew's dad again. He emailed 2 weeks ago about corners, and he now says, having stirred up a debate about corners last time, and now banging on about throw-ins. Firstly, after Robinson's disastrous effort v Villa, do we need a throw-in coach? Yep. So many seem to go up the line, and we lose possession, so I understand why he tried an alternative. Maybe we need to go back to the drawing board. He then says, also, have you noticed how many throws by both sides are unpenalised foul throws.
Oh my God, it's like I have my own dad.
Not taking the ball over your head, having both feet on the ground. I've even seen jumping. Rant over, next week, set pieces. Michael.
My dad, when it comes to Fulham, we have two seasons between the three of us, but he comes regularly when my brother isn't there. And I've never seen anybody shout about foul throws. Foul throw ref. I was like, Dad, they haven't given a foul throw in a game for like years. I mean, they're both Michael and my father are correct, right? Like, you are supposed to abide by the rules, but also, like, the referee isn't supposed to have the ball in his hands for more than 6 days. Like, they're sort of rules, but they're sort of not. Like, it's kind of fine. He makes a bang spot on point, though, that we need a throw-in coach. We're so bad at throw-ins, like, really bad at them.
Are we that bad? Normally we just throw it to Tom Kearney, who passes it back to the fullback.
No, but like, we get throws in attacking areas and do absolute nada with them. Like, how many goals Brentford score from throw-ins? Like, and when Liverpool had Thomas Gronemark, like, the amount that you can squeeze out of the small drops when you're a club trying to punch upwards is incredible. I think that it shouldn't be your entire personality. And I am looking at those dads down the road that, you know, oh, when you have a throwing coach, your throwing coach says, Matthias Jensen, leng it long. Like, that's not throw-in coaching. But when you do have a strategy, like, you can make the most out of loads of different things. And I think that's important. And as a side who are now 2 years where we'll finish almost certainly mid-table, but far enough back from the European places, they'd be like, there's a step up to get there. I'm like, why would we not be trying to squeeze every single last drop out of the situations in games that you can plan for? Set-piece coaches, throw-in coaches. I think all of this is massive.
How do we know that we don't have a throw-in coach?
That is true. Well, if we do, I'm going to be absolutely livid. So there's that. But yeah.
I mean, it's just this always thing that, like, Brentford have all these coaches. Do we know, Peter, that we don't have someone that's pretty good at throwing coaches? I guess that's not the kind of detail that any of us really get given.
Yeah, I don't think there's a specific single role throwing coach, as far as I'm aware. But I'm happy to be corrected on that. I'm pretty sure that's not right.
Yeah. I'd like to see that on Indeed.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe you should apply for it, Jack.
Maybe. I don't know very much about throw-ins, apart from I know that Fulham aren't very good at them. So there's that. So
Fulham hire Rory Delap, throwing coach.
Honestly, yeah, I think this is it. We can't remember the last time we had real long throws. I remember John Arnorisi used to think he was really good at them, and then he'd throw it, he'd like take the big run up, he'd throw it, and it would get to sort of the edge of the area. Like, what are you doing? Stop thinking you've got a cannon there when you just throw it to the edge of the area. Madman.
Do we have anyone for a long throw? Not really. I mean, Anthony Robinson.
There's sometimes late in the game. Anthony Robinson,
yeah, has a bit of a slingshot on him.
Yeah. It's not like a Delap one, though, that's causing absolute
no,
chaos.
He still needs a flick on, but he can get it, you know, halfway between the edge of the box and the six-yard box. That's a bit...
There's not enough space for a run-up, though, is there, between the touchline and the terrace? I don't think.
Yeah, yeah, well, he needs a unique throw-in coach who can train you how to guard.
Well, what if we start doing those ones,
you know,
where someone like stands in front and you throw it off their back and and it drops down to your feet and off you go, like, bosh.
I never forget when I saw that one, which I think is fully legal, where someone went on their knees to take a throw-in.
Yeah.
And it is a legal way of doing it. I mean, yeah. It looks weird.
So is the flip. The flip's also legal. If you can get the run-up, the flip is legal.
Like Iranian player in the World Cup who got it wrong.
Yeah, well, that was bad. But if you can do it, the flip is completely legal. Anthony Robinson can definitely flip. Let's get him doing that late in games. It'd be unbelievable.
I want Anthony Robinson flip throw to Rodrigo Muniz's bicycle kick. One day, the ultimate goal.
Well, this is it. We may as well just finish football at that point, right? Like, just cancel it. It's done. We've won. So
we've won.
Fulham won football over. See you later.
Trophies in cabinet. Rodrigo Muniz scored a bicycle kick off a flip throw.
Yeah, exactly. Done. See you later.
Right. Final thing for the pod today is a This'll Catch On. This is from Andy Stevens. He titles it, "This Will Definitely Catch On." Confident from Andy.
Wow, big stuff. He
says, "Hi, Fulhamish. We need songs for our strikers. It's been too long since He Who Must Not Be Named left, and it's time we moved on. Raul is still our best hope." He literally wrote this the other day as well. I don't know what he's saying.
He's not even old.
"And we need something to instantly sing when he scores, or more likely narrowly missed with a Rabona. He's Mexican. Let's embrace it. Tequila is gone. The Los Lambas classic Bambaleo is still available. I thought about lyrics about his head injury and not scoring, but thoughts just shouting ole ole is more fun. So I've kept it simple and sung this in my car." So this is from Andy.
Jimenez, Jimenez. Ole, 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 Jimenez. Jimenez, Jimenez. Ole, 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 Jimenez.
Great voice, Starting Andy. Well. serious. That was back serious.
It seemed to get a bit lost.
The syllable police is going to go. It's just going to happen. I'm going to have to send the syllable police around, I'm afraid. We can't be having an extra syllable in Jimenez or Jimenez. That's unfortunately unacceptable.
I do think Bambaleo is not a bad tune. Maybe
Bambaleo is an unbelievable tune. If you can make it work, it's a really, really good football tune. But that ain't it.
Peter, your thoughts?
It started well. It didn't work for me. It's a bit too jarring.
Yeah, back to the drawing boards, Andy. But
quite like the Jimenez. I just can't imagine the hammy end ever doing that.
Jimenez.
I mean, there's a bit of creative license. Look, I'll give Andy this. It's a good go. And I do like the attempt at trying to get something like last week where we had something that will actually, it could actually catch on. So props to Andy for that.
I think my
syllable stuff is going wild. I'm afraid I just can't. I can't endorse it.
All right, that'll do for the podcast today. Thank you ever so much for listening. Being a lot of fun. Great to have Peter back. Peter, thank you for coming in.
No worries. Thanks for having me.
And Jack, thank you.
No, thank you, Sammy. Always a pleasure.
The pod will be back Monday, sometime, looking back at the Brighton game. And we'll be back with the Thursday Club this time next week. So have a good weekend. Whatever you do, if you're heading to the cottage, enjoy. If you're watching from wherever you are around the world, enjoy it too. Come on, you whites.
You whites.